Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And today I get to talk monsters of Greek mythology with a guest, Professor of Greek Mythology, Dr. Sue Hardebeck.
Childhood.
Yeah, so what got you into Greek mythology?
Well, my first exposure to it was when I was a little kid, and my aunt and uncle had a set of these encyclopedias in the basement that just seemed to be about different things. They didn't really seem like a normal set of encyclopedias. So I was reading about Harry Houdini, and I read about Halley's Comet, and I was looking forward to it coming back around, you know, that whole thing. And then I read about Pelops with the ivory shoulder, and I just thought that was so cool that there was this guy walking around with an ivory shoulder, and I couldn't, like, wrap my head around it. I think I had a visual image of a wing instead of a shoulder when I was a little kid, you know, because it came out from about the same place. But that was my first exposure, and then I had the usual junior high assignment when we covered the gods and goddesses, and I'm a Renaissance literature person, so there's tons of mythological allusions in that stuff. So I finally, actually, because I didn't really do much with it in high school, and I didn't take the heroes course that everybody else took. I got on a different track somehow. So I missed a lot of stuff, and I went and took a mythology course. They just audited it, and she told every story, I think, that was known to man. I don't know. I went to the lectures, and she just stood up there and lectured, and it was fun. It filled in all the gaps. And then when I got here, I got offered the chance to teach it.
Well, so, I got started on the, do you remember the Edith Hamilton books?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Yeah. Like, I found that in a basement as a kid. I, like, came across that.
Yeah.
I was, like, reading The Hobbit at the time as a little kid, and I found this. And I'm like, there's a whole world of all these amazing. And then it had pictures in it, too, which were nothing like I imagined anything. So I could, like, argue with the artist in the book and stuff like that. So.
Well, I should mention all the movies that they made, too, because, like, when the first Clash of the Titans came out, I saw that, and that's when I got interested in Perseus, though that movie's all wrong. Now I know better. And it really messes me up. Yes, the
what's Kraken.
What's
a Kraken doing there in the ancient
I don't know. They just stole the name. They needed a sea monster, but it didn't have a name in the myth, so they stole it from Norse mythology. But before that, there were the Sunday afternoon movies like Jason and the Argonauts with Ray Harryhausen bottles in them. And I love those movies too, but that skeleton fight, that scared crap out of me.
That was really good. It still kind of holds up if you're okay with like the clip, like the stop motion thing. It's pretty freaking
if you get
amazing.
Past the little jumpiness there, it's really good. I agree.
So I've hit you with this question before on email, and I normally wait till the end, but I want to ask you now. Of all the Greek monsters, and there are like a ton in Greek mythology,
a ton.
I don't think we're in one episode, we're just barely going to scratch the surface and just get into a few of them. And that's maybe another direction I want to lead is like, why are the Greeks monster obsessive more than other cultures? But out of all the Greek monsters, what's your favorite?
God, I keep changing my mind, but I told you the other day it was the Lernaean Hydra.
Yeah.
And that's still at the top. Medusa's up there. And then there are some lesser known monsters that I like. I don't know why I like them, but they seem to all have the same feature of something is multiple about them. So there's a group of them called the Hecatoncheires, and they have...
Hecatoncheires?
The Hecatoncheires. They play a small role in the Titanomachy, the big battle between the gods and the Titans. Yeah. And the Hecatoncheires have 50 heads and 100 arms and 100 hands. And there are three of them. And the advantage that they give Zeus in the Titanomachy is you can't kill the Titans, but you can bury them under rock. And so no matter how, you know, many thunderbolts Zeus throws, it doesn't defeat the Titans. But he releases the Hecatoncheires from Tartarus, and they become his allies. And they throw 300 rocks at a time, and they bury the Titans, subdue them enough so that they can be imprisoned in Tartarus. In the underworld.
And that's kind of terrifying.
It is terrifying, but but it's like, okay, they're good because they're on the good side. You're supposed to root for the gods at that point.
Yeah.
And so then they become the prison guards in Tartarus. So they're not like above Earth with us. We don't have to worry about them.
Okay. Because that the whole burying the thing under the rock thing, like that keeps coming up. That's not only in Norse mythology too, but that even comes up with the Hydra. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that. Why is the Hydra one of your favorites?
The Hydra, I think because, again, it's probably influenced a little bit by something I saw in a movie, but also because the multiple heads make it a complex labor for Heracles. It's his second labor that he's on, and he runs into this giant serpent-like creature with all the 9 heads in the marshes of Lernaea. And he starts clubbing them. That's his weapon of choice. You know, club a head, clubs a head off.
Keeps
and
it simple.
Two grow in its place. That's the thing that really catches you. It isn't just that he's got to lop off all 9 heads, but 2 grow back. So what do you do when that happens?
Yeah.
Because you're just making your problem worse. And so it's his nephew who's along for the trip on this one.
Yeah,
Iolaus. I'm not exactly sure. Yeah, and he suggests that they cauterize the neck so that they can't grow back heads. So that works for 8 of the heads. And then, like you said, like you're getting to the rock burying part, the immortal head that can't die has to be put under a rock.
Yeah, the Hydra has many heads, but just like one of them is the real immortal one.
Yeah.
And so it can't die.
Yeah.
That's the crazy thing about Greek mythology is like it takes its like own like house rule of immortality mm-hmm. like really seriously. Like if you're immortal, you get to live forever, but that you also are stuck not dying. Like if you're in pain and you mm-hmm. you're immortal or you get buried, you're just like awful. Or that I can't remember what's his name got like given immortality but not eternal youth, so he like got really old and turned into like dust and he's still there. Is that who
yeah
they take that immortality like way too serious. Is it like a joke to them as well or something? I don't know
if it's a joke. I've never really thought whether it's a joke or not.
Being a pile of dust and you're still complaining is a bit funny, but maybe it's just to me.
I think that kind of falls under the heading of be careful what you ask for. Though he didn't ask for immortality, it was his consort. I think it's Eos, the goddess of the dawn.
Yeah, goddess of the dawn.
And she wants to keep him around, and so she asks for him to be made immortal. But somebody always forgets some little detail, and so he isn't giving you eternal youth. And as you say, he turns into dust, and there's an alternate story where he just turns into a grasshopper at the end. But Tithonus is just one in the long line of be careful what you ask for.
Yeah, well, the Greeks are litigious about their wishes.
They are, yes. Yeah.
Okay, so for the Hydra, so you've got a scenario where you've got a problem you've got to solve, and every attempt to do so just makes it more
mm-hmm.
until you find a way to just stop the problems from regrowing. I think that seems like deeply applicable to a lot of things. Like there are a lot of, I think, approaches to regular problems that you could learn a Hydra approach to. Like you're just making your problem worse every time you try to solve it.
Yeah.
You're doing it wrong.
Quit banging your head against that wall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Quit trying to do it the way you think you ought to do it.
Right.
Yeah. Heracles isn't always known for being able to think outside the box. So he needs some help along the way, even from Athena. He's got to clean out the Augean stables, which are just rife with muck that's never been cleaned for, decades. And it's Athena who says, well, why don't you divert the flow of a couple of rivers and just shoot it through there? It's not Heracles thinking of it, but it's Heracles carrying out the plan.
And so, and since he's not so broke, he needed his nephew.
Yeah.
What's the right pronunciation?
Iolaus.
Iolaus, yeah. So he needed Iolaus to help. But what Iolaus, like, if I'm remembering it correctly, he, like, took part in the cauterizing of the wounds to help him out. And then word got back, and Heracles wasn't supposed to get any help. And so, like, they discounted that one. So he had, like, 10 labors. And then he had to, like, they added an 11th one after that. And then the stable one, then he, like, accept payment for doing it too, and he wasn't supposed to do that, so they added like a so he keeps, even though he solves it, he keeps screwing up and they like discount it. Like, talk, was it, are these all, are the Greeks all warriors?
Well, then Heracles is performing the labors as atonement for killing his family, which
Sorry, of course.
We have to mention that, you know, he was thrown into that state of frenzy and madness by Hera, who hates him because he's the product of an affair. Zeus has many, but Heracles seems to take the brunt of most of her vindictiveness.
Yeah.
And in the even in the Hydra episode, she adds another little problem. She throws a crab out there to nip at Heracles' heels while he's trying to deal with the Hydra. So we have to be a little softer, a little kinder with Heracles, I think, because he is, you know, both sides, two things going on at once, trying to figure out what to do about the problems. So he needs a little help.
Doesn't that become cancer? Like that actual crab?
Yeah.
Being in the sky?
Yeah, Hera puts it and makes a constellation out of it. Like, good job, little crab. A little pat on the
head. You messed him up just enough. Yeah.
But Heracles doesn't learn. Well, I guess Heracles is typical patriarchal male.
Yeah.
Because he's got mistresses coming out. Yeah. So he's never really truly faithful to any of his wives. But at some point he's got to serve as a slave for the Queen of Lydia. And it's like he doesn't learn. So now yet he's being punished again.
Yeah.
See, he kind of goes through these cycles of punishment for things he does.
Yeah, and that and the Hydra come back around to bite him again, like his wife being uncertain about his faith for good reason.
And
the Hydra. So, because you were bringing this up when I was asking you to be on the podcast earlier about how really that Hydra incident links all the way up to his horrid death, really. And so the Hydra is not only like a big horrifying multi-headed serpent in the swamp, but it's also like hyper poisonous.
Yes.
Right. And so how does that link up?
Well, Heracles decides he's going to dip his arrows in the poison and make them even more lethal than they normally would be.
Yeah.
And so later on, when he's married for the second time, I think it is, he and his wife come to a river that's moving too fast for him to cross with her. And so he lets a centaur who's got evil designs on his wife. But Heracles doesn't know it. He lets the centaur Nessus take his wife across the river. And before Heracles can cross, Nessus starts to attempt to violate her. And so Heracles takes the trusty bow and arrow and shoots Nessus and delivers a fatal wound. And as the centaur is dying, I think he realizes that he's doing Heracles in with this, but he tells Deianira, Heracles' wife, to gather some of the blood and keep it because she can use it to keep Heracles faithful. So fast forward a few years, he's had a few mistresses, and then one mistress in particular named Iole that he won in some archery contest from, she's the daughter of a king, and he has to take her by force because the father doesn't want to let her go to Heracles. And Heracles sends her on ahead home with a messenger, and Deianira, of course, gets the message, you know, he's coming home and he's bringing home a mistress this time. So she decides to take that centaur blood, which now has the Hydra poison mixed in with it, smears it on a shirt and sends it back with the messenger to deliver to Heracles, because Heracles is supposed to, he's won some victory recently. So there's going to be a sacrifice to Zeus in honor of Zeus's greatness or whatever. And as soon as he gets too close to the fire warms up the blood and activates the poison. and it begins to have the effect that napalm has, and all of his flesh starts burning right off the bone. And of course, he's in agonizing, terrible pain. He starts racing around. Trees are falling down. People are jumping back from him until finally he ends up in some other area. I can't remember. Mount Eda? And he asks to be put on a funeral pyre and killed. So he commits suicide, but who wouldn't?
you're burning, your flesh is burning up, and it just will not stop.
And luckily for him, he's a demigod, so only the mortal part dies, and the immortal part gets then to go to Mount Olympus, where he's married yet a third time, but this time to a goddess. Yeah. So it seems, and he's reconciled with Hera magically as they end up being when they have to live together.
The happy ending now.
Yeah, a little happy ending, really hard won happy ending, but.
So the centaurs ended up in that story. I wanted to ask you a little bit about centaurs. Like, is there like a centaur story that stands out to you, or what's up with centaurs?
Well, I did a little research because I really don't talk too much about centaurs except for the odd one that shows up in somebody else's myth.
Yeah.
But you have Chiron, who is the oldest and wisest centaur. He's a son of Cronos, and Cronos was like the second sky god. He's the Titan that he leads the rest of the Titans in the war against the gods.
Yeah.
He's Zeus's father. And he had an affair, or was in the middle of a tryst with another, I don't know, a female nymph or something like that. And his wife, Rhea, discovered them in the middle of the act. And he attempted to hide who he was by turning himself into a horse. And that resulted in the half-man, half-horse Chiron.
so he's not even of the regular centaur.
No, the other centaurs are descendants of a character named Ixion, who is punished in the underworld for trying to put the moves on Hera. And he had a son. Am I getting this right? Centaurus?
That sounds
something
about
like
right.
that.
Yeah.
He had,
there's
a line of men and then a line of centaurs that
is it
come from Ixion.
Am I supposed to say kentaur?
I don't know. I think we say centaurs so much we can't go back to kentaurs, but I've seen it spelled with the K.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I like Cerberus, but then there's Kerberus,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's actually, I guess it's Kerberus. I don't
Yeah.
Remember. So Chiron, it was really cool. Like, I first ran into him in, I think it was William Morris's version of the Jason story, when, like, Jason gets thrown out in the woods and, like, you're going to get a mentor soon. Good luck surviving this guy. He's, like, really good, but tough on you. And then he hears through the leaves these, like, hooves a-tromping, and then here comes Chiron.
What a great entrance.
Yeah, it's a really cool moment. There are a few other little details that I'm blanking on, but I have the picture in my mind. Like, this bearded horse-like thing coming through this, like, wall of foliage, and this terrified little Jason just trembling about this private school he's about to go into for several years. That's going to be school of hard knocks indeed. But so Chiron, this centaur, was just not only like the mentor of Jason, but a few others too, like some of the top dogs, right?
Like Peleus and Achilles.
Achilles, yeah, as well. Yeah. Achilles' dad, too? Was that right?
It's Peleus.
Peleus. And there are another couple. But anyway, so you're teaching Achilles, Jason, and then, a handful of others. This guy, what does he know?
I guess just around long enough, you know everything. Yeah. You know, but I guess he's responsible for teaching them archery and the sword and
because that's their favorite. I guess their weapon of choice,
The bow and arrow. Yeah, that's how I always saw them depicted when I was a kid looking at pictures of centaurs, which was kind of fascinating. All these half animal, half man creatures, or some sort of combination of animal and human being, like the sirens with the women's faces, but they're bird-like otherwise, or the harpies that have wings, but women's heads. And
Or like furies type of things, too. Or Medusa. I mean, you brought up Medusa. Let's talk about Medusa for a moment. Like, she's... Yeah. Right, she's one of
three Gorgons,
but she's like the one who doesn't get to be immortal. Yeah, too, right. Is that right?
Yeah, we're gonna screw her from the beginning, and then we're gonna make it worse.
Yeah, so she didn't start off with like ugly with snake hair, right? She was beautiful. So what happened?
It depends. In some early versions of the myth, she is just as ugly as her sisters. They're all depicted as having, you know, a couple of tusks hanging out of their face and the snaky hair and stuff.
Yeah.
But in later classical authors wanted to make Medusa beautiful, so they did. So they kind of turn her into a priestess of Athena serving in her temple. And then Poseidon saw her, wanted her. And you can read it as either she went willingly along, though I think it's probably he forced himself on her. And then Athena can't do anything to Poseidon, so like Hera, she punishes the poor woman, the victim, and she turns her into a Gorgon.
Now that's...
Or she makes her, doesn't turn her into a Gorgon, but gives her the snaky hair and the, you know, takes away her beauty.
Yeah.
But they all have that cool power of being able to turn people into stone if you look upon their face. That's just really cool.
Yeah, they're so either they're so hideous or they're so magical or something.
Yeah.
Like they turn to stone. And so Perseus, right? He's the one who fights her and beheads her. He's outfitted to the nines, by the way. He's
The gods are so helpful to him.
He does. He's got the magic sword. He's got the magic shoes. He's got the magic... Bad.
He's got the cap of invisibility. It's like, wow, what I wouldn't do to get that cap.
And so he lops off her head, but it still works. Like anyone who looks directly upon their head still turns to stone. That's potent.
And then even her blood is venomous because he puts it in a bag and carries it back with him to his island home. But along the way, some of the blood drips onto Libya and poisonous snakes form. And at some other point, he encounters the Titan Atlas holding up the world, you know, and Atlas won't give him a place to rest his weary bones. And so he pulls that out and zaps him. And now we have the Atlas Mountains.
Yeah, because
you know, some Greek myths are just meant to explain why things exist.
Yeah.
And then in third place, he puts the heads back in the bag again. He puts it down on some seaweed so he can wash his hands and turns the seaweed into coral.
Huh.
Which is really cool. That I don't know how much coral's there on the Aegean.
And didn't the Pegasus come out of her body too?
After her head's cut off.
Yeah, so it was like a child that she just wouldn't birth or something. Well, I don't know what it was.
Poseidon I don't know why he's still in there, but it makes sense because Poseidon was the creator of horses.
Yeah.
And so then a horse-like creature comes out, makes sense. Yeah. And then there's another... A giant of some sort named Chrysaor who comes out, and he's the half-brother of Echidna, I think, in the genealogy, which is really complicated.
Yeah. But, we're going to have to get to Echidna.
Yes.
There are plenty of other kind of like snake-like things or basilisks or other like monsters that they have a serpentine feature to them. But also, if you look upon them, it'll turn to stone.
Mm-hmm.
And I never put the... Well, I didn't put the two together until I heard someone talking about, like, one of the defense mechanisms. Like, we so often talk about fight or flight. And it's like, that's two of three. One of them is freeze. Like, it's fight or flight or freeze. And sometimes freezing works. And so you see a snake, one of the first things you do is just, like, some people... I do. I leap back and then freeze. I just freeze right there. And so maybe that's something. I don't know if that's connected. Or
it's like the cobra. The way the cobra can kind of mesmerize you.
Yeah.
And we try to mesmerize it with the song and hypnotize it, but it seems to be just this hypnotic, you know, like in Jungle Book.
Yeah. Yeah, Kaa.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's a good serpent. I did an episode on serpents and dragons, and I wanted to get to Kaa too, and didn't. But I mean, Medusa is her own version. She needs to be in there too.
Yeah.
But like, so, all right, so people listening to this and didn't know the backstory of Medusa might be thinking, well, hold up, that's like super blame the victim. What's going on
yes.
there? And like, as far as I can tell, a lot of the ancient cultures would, in their stories, would have elements that they wouldn't blink an eye at, but that would really upset us, and mm-hmm. that now it's unfair to get punished for something that you never actually intended to be a part of, or you didn't intend to do, or you're the victim mm-hmm. of somebody else's crime. But as far as I can tell, in a lot of the ancients, like the Greeks, it didn't matter whether you meant to or not, or whether you're to blame, only whether you did it or not. Like the Ark of the Covenant, like mm-hmm. it's on its way to falling, and one guy like reaches out real fast to steady it, and he immediately gets struck down dead mm-hmm. by Yahweh because he touched it.
No touching.
Hold on, he was just trying to help, and he did help. But there's something to it. Like, it doesn't matter. The rules are the rules.
Exactly. And you follow the rules or you get punished. Yeah.
Yeah, like some things you run into at your own peril, some things you're not to blame, but you still were a part of it. And so, like, she's not supposed to get raped in a temple.
Or she's not supposed to have sex in a temple. Because Athena is a virginal goddess.
Yeah.
So none of the hanky-panky. If this had been Aphrodite's temple, things would have been cool. Nothing would have happened.
She would have been rewarded or something like
She would have been like, well, see if you could do it again.
Yeah, so she gets punished for something that wasn't even her fault. But I guess the Greeks were just totally fine. Like, that made perfect sense to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Echidna.
Yes.
One of these the monsters in literature live events thing, somebody brought up her. They were like, she said, like, why'd you skip over her? She's the mother of all monsters.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, well, there are a few reasons why I skipped over her, but that doesn't mean she doesn't deserve a place because she's amazing. So give us the rundown on Echidna. Like, what did she end up?
Okay, well, for that, I'm going to turn to my friend Hesiod, who wrote the Theogony, which is kind of a little like reading the Bible, but it's the creation stories. It's a little, you know, this guy begat this guy, but here's his description of her. Mostly that she's burying one monster after another, and she bore another monster. This would be... I forget who Echidna's mother is. But this is Echidna. Irresistible, not like mortal men at all or immortal gods. Bore it in a hollow cave, divine, brutal Echidna. Half-dancing-eyed nymph with pretty cheeks, half-horrible serpent, an iridescent monster eating raw flesh in sacred earth's dark crypts. Her cave is deep underground in the hollow rock, far from mortal men and from immortal gods. Her glorious home, and there she keeps guard in underground Arima, grim Echidna, a nymph immortal in all her days, ageless. So then she mates with the dragon that Gaia brings forth after the Titanomachy is over, and she brings forth giants. She seems to turn on Zeus at some point, perhaps because the battle with the Titans had been so intense. They practically burned the earth to a crisp Zeus practically did with all his thunderbolts. So she brings forth the giants, and the giants battle Zeus and are defeated. And then she brings forth Typhoeus, or Typhon, who is this huge dragon with several serpent body ends and 100 heads or something like that, 100 tongues, speaking all these different languages. So just the din of that creature would just be crazy. And then it kind of mates with that and gives birth to Orthus, who becomes the dog star, Sirius the dog star later on after Heracles kills him. But he is the Hound of Geryon, a three-bodied monster, which is just fascinating to me. Three bodies somehow connected all together. So there are three heads, three torsos, three, you know, six arms, six legs. I can't imagine what that would look like. But Heracles takes his cattle, so he slays Geryon and the herdsman and Orthus, who's a two-headed dog, not a three-headed dog. Then Cerberus is also Echidna's offspring, the three-headed hound of Hades, which is described as Hades' bronze baying hound. Bronze baying hound.
That's bronze was in there. I wonder what to make of that.
I don't know. It also says that Cerberus is 50-headed. 50 heads in Hesiod. What?
Yeah, I remember Jorge Borges saying something like, his theory was it went from 50 heads down to 3 because it's easier to sculpt 3 than 50.
I think so. It took me years to find a picture or a drawing of the 100-handers.
Yeah.
And even then, you can't count all of the heads or all of the hands or anything. It's funny. Right. Then the Hydra is also her offspring. The Chimera is her offspring. Usually the lion head, the goat body, the dragon tail. Yeah.
And the volcano.
Yes. Yeah. And Hesiod has a wonderful description. And she bore Chimera, who breathed raging fire. And she was dreadful and huge and fast and strong. And she had 3 heads. One of a green-eyed lion, one of a goat, and one of a serpent, a gnarly dragon, lion in front, dragon in the rear, goat in the middle, so you can't decide where they go. And every exhalation was a breath of pure flame. And then is it Chimera who's the mother of Sphinx? Because the pronouns are getting sketchy here. Or is it Echidna who's the mother of Sphinx?
She meets with Orthos then. Echidna, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah, she mates with Orthus, her son, the two-headed dog, and produces the Sphinx. And the Nemean lion that Heracles has to face.
Yeah, the first one. Yeah.
Yeah. And I like that episode a lot, too, because that's another one. Actually, he comes up with the solution on his own, because the Nemean lion's hide cannot be penetrated by an arrow or sword or anything, and so he couldn't just zap it with an arrow and kill it, and tried clubbing it, and there's 2 versions. He could club it to death, or he ends up strangling it to death. And then he takes the hide as a prize, and he uses the lion's claws in order to skin it.
Yeah.
It just, you know, that's the moment where you go, well, this guy's got a brain.
Yeah. It can't be penetrated by anything except itself, right?
Yeah, and it's one of those satisfying rules that you like, you know, when you read something.
Wasn't that kind of the details on the Minotaur too? And didn't Theseus like break off the Minotaur's horn and like stab him with his own horn or something? Am I making that up?
I thought maybe he had a sword. You know, Heracles breaks off a river god's horn.
Okay, maybe that's
what it's. Maybe that's about. What you're confusing it with. Okay. But that could be a version, because there are plenty of versions of different myths floating around. But I know the version where Ariadne, the daughter of the king, leaves a sword just inside the entrance to the labyrinth, Theseus uses that sword.
Okay. So for Echidna, this mother, like, she turned out like a whole big, like, star-studded cast of monsters. Yeah. She seems a lot, like, there's a Mesopotamian story of Tiamat, like this, the primordial dragon goddess of the sea, and she gives birth to all these monsters, but they don't have their own personalities like that. I wonder how much crossover there is, like Echidna as being some, like, I don't know, the original version or a takeoff of.
There could be, because there are a lot of similarities between the Greek flood story and the Epic of Gilgamesh, that flood story.
Yeah. So as a rough segue to the other cultures, one question I keep trying to figure out is, like, you've got other cultures of roughly that area and that era that we call, like, the ancient Greek culture. I mean, that's a rough designation, right?
Right.
But roughly in that area, you have others. You know, you have some Mesopotamians, but they have some stories that seem a lot similar. But then you've got, like, the Israelites, right, or the Hebrews, who roughly at the same time, in producing similar literature in some ways,
but they don't. They have some giants and kind of a few critters, but they don't really have monsters. In fact, I don't know of anybody who has just monster after monster like the Greeks. So why?
So why do the Greeks have so many monsters? And I don't know. Part of it seems to be that some of the monsters can be traced back to Gaia and Pontus, even the children of Echidna. She's descended from Gaia and Pontus, and Pontus is the sea. So it makes me think that the Greeks, who were more sailors than, say, the Israelites, perhaps, that they journeyed around the Mediterranean, however close to shore they did that, in case they fell out of the boat. But that makes me think they thought about what was in that sea, and they couldn't, they had to speculate. They had no way of exploring it. We still don't know what is in the ocean in its entirety. So I think that's part of the imagination and the fear that they had. And
that makes, I mean, the Norse have a ton of monsters, too. And they're very seafaring.
And they're both and they're both a warrior race.
Yeah.
And the Israelites were enslaved for so long by the Egyptians.
Yeah, and Babylonians.
And the Babylonians. Yeah. And they always had difficulty maintaining their place. So maybe they didn't have time to have that imagination to put into... They didn't. They had enough to fear from people. They didn't have to fear anything from monsters.
Yeah.
But so much of Greek literature is about the warrior and battles. Like, you don't get a lot of... I'm trying to think hard if you get anything out of the Iliad or the Odyssey. Well, yeah, I get some out of the Odyssey. But you don't get very many monsters in the Iliad. You get a lot of interference from the gods. Yeah. And that's about all the mythology they need.
Yeah, I remember Achilles wrestling the river at one point, and that was about it.
Yeah, yes, so, he's wrestling the river, becomes personified, and is upset with all the bodies he's putting into it, and decides to rebel against Achilles.
But most of the other heroes are essentially made out of just monster slaying, like Heracles, Theseus, Perseus, a ton of them is...
Yeah, it's like they're the least tied to something that may have actually happened.
Yeah.
In the Iliad, we have some idea that Troy existed now, and there may have been a great war between the Greeks and the Trojans, or there may not have.
I guess the closer you get into history, like the farther you get away from monsters. But I guess some people would be... Like, I think Tolkien's speculation that, you know, once you start introducing the fantastical and, like, monsters into it, you're kind of asking listeners or readers to maybe elevate the applicability of it. It's not just about what happened at Troy, you know, when Heracles is fighting the Hydra. It's not just like what happened in the swamp one day on a Tuesday afternoon. It's like, it's how you confront all sorts of problems in life. And like those you can't cauterize. Sometimes maybe you have to find the real one that won't go away, and just bury that under a rock and run away.
Yeah.
And don't let it bite you in the ass years later when you're trying to use it.
Yeah.
I don't really know.
I don't know either. Huh. And some of the creatures are just, you know, bigger versions of a regular animal, or tougher versions of a regular animal.
Yeah.
Like, there are at least three boar-like creatures that they deal with. The Caledonian boar that was said to be huge and fierce and rampaging the countryside and terrorizing the people of Caledonia. There was the sow of Chromion that Theseus faced off against, which was huge, too. And then the Erymanthian boar that Heracles was sent to fetch, bring back, and then release again. So it was a little catch and release program for him. And it's like, what's with all the pigs, people?
And I guess maybe it's part of that kind of like their, you know, that Greek push to civilization. Mm-hmm. Like they don't seem to have as many like mortal on mortal revenge stories as maybe some of the others. But, you know, maybe it's because they keep pushing more toward that court-like civilization. I don't know if it's like taming the wilderness. You got to kill off all the monsters so we can build a city or something. I don't know.
Yeah, Well, the battle with the centaurs is supposed to be kind of an expression of civilizing something wild, because when they get drunk at the wedding that they've been invited to, all hell breaks loose and they start trying to rape all the women.
Centaurs have traditionally a problem with alcohol.
Right? Yeah. And they drank the wine undiluted as well, so they made it worse. But you know, that doesn't forgive them their excesses. But apparently it's kind of the idea is of the warrior who finds himself in peacetime and doesn't know how to fit back in. That theme I've picked up a couple of different places. And
are there any monsters that you were really wanting to get to mention today?
Well, I like the story with Argus.
Tell us about that.
Okay. Zeus, as is his wont, spied a beautiful young woman, and so he wanted to have her. So he gathered clouds around to hide what he was doing from Hera, which is really smart.
Yeah.
You know. So he went and forced himself on Io, this beautiful young woman. And then he realized that Hera was approaching. So he quickly transformed Io into a cow, this beautiful white cow. And Hera, though, she was wise to Zeus that when he was sneaking around a little bit and acting a little strange, knew that there was a reason why the cow was there. And so she said, could you give me the cow as a gift? It's so beautiful. I want to keep that. And he's backed into a corner. He either confesses or he goes along. So he goes along for a while and he gives Io over to Hera, who then puts a guard over Io so she can't return to her family, or she can't return to her former life, or can't return to Zeus and carry on what they were doing. That's the real reason. And Argus is this creature that has 50 pairs of eyes. I don't know how to envision that, but no more than 2 eyes shut at a time. So he's the perfect watchman. You set him over her, he never fully falls asleep. And he watches Io grazing, he watches Io walking along, he watches Io with her family trying to convey that, you know, she still has her human consciousness inside and she's trying to convey who she is. She's pawing the I and the O in the dirt with her hoof, and family figures out this is our daughter who's been lost to us. There's weeping, there's lamentations, and still Argus watches her. And so Zeus finally can't stand it anymore, and he sends Hermes down with a flute to lull Argus asleep. And between telling him stories and playing the flute, Argus's eyes shut a little bit at a time until he's finally fully asleep. And then out comes the sword and lop off his head. And so he's killed. And that doesn't end the torment for Io, but Hera does this really nice thing. This is another one of those myths that explains how something came to be. She takes all the eyes and puts them on the tail of the peacock.
Yeah.
And it's so pretty and yet so sad at the same time. But the peacock was her favorite bird. This is her favorite creature, Argus.
Yeah.
And so I really like that story. I like the idea of having somebody who could protect you with 100 eyes.
Yeah.
But not that he's used in that way.
That's a cool one. And we keep coming back to maybe one of your weird hangups. So, Dr. Hardebeck, yes. What's your deal with multiple things?
I don't know. I like heads, the three-body monster.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened to me in my childhood watching those Ray Harryhausen movies. I don't know. It's just fascinating to me somehow. Maybe, too, it has something to do with I don't feel personally threatened by this monster. I'm not ever going to encounter this type of monster.
Yeah.
Sometimes like the Hundred Handers, the Hecatoncheires, it's on the side of good.
Yeah.
Argus doesn't seem particularly threatening to Io, just wants to make sure that she can't encounter Zeus again.
Huh.
So maybe that's why. But there is something about trying to envision what that monster would look like that's a little bit challenging too.
Yeah,
the Hydra's easy, but the other ones are harder to figure out. Yeah. Where would you put all these heads? And
because you don't see much art depicting them, I think. Mm-mm. In fact, because sometimes it kind of be impossible, and it's like that problem of like the difference between perceiving something and conceiving of something. Like, you can't really perceive a shape with like 20,000 sides. It'll just look like a circle to you. But you could conceive of one. You could imagine what that would be. You just can't, when you're confronted with it, you can't
name
see
it because you have enough of a root. You know, a Greek root you could add and call it a dodecahedron.
Yeah. So somebody listening to this right now probably knows
the 20-sided figure.
Off the top of their head, I don't know. You can't perceive it, but you could conceive it. And some of those, like the, you know, the 100 hands and 100 head, like you can't really render that, but you can sure imagine that you can.
Right.
That's something's fascinating about that.
Yeah, and even Argus with the 100 eyes, I have seen a couple of depictions, and basically what they do is draw a human man and then just try to fit eyes all over his body. And in the worst version of it that I've seen, it looks like the poor guy's got leprosy. It's just a drawing, just a line drawing, a pen and ink drawing of some kind, I think. And just little puckered areas are supposed to look like eyelids and an eye, and it just looks crazy. And then some other versions, it's more of a painting, and but they don't do nearly enough eyes. There's no way you could do that.
Yeah, because you need all the eyes on his head. That's where they're supposed to be, but there's no way to do it. But it's there. It's somehow true.
Yeah, so that they put it up and down his arms and his legs, and it just looks unnatural. Maybe we know too much about how the optic nerve works, too. We can't let go. Of course, he could be able to use all of them to see. They would all go back to the brain. Sure.
But, I mean, at any given time now, like, you have people, like, it would have been, you could have only thought of a monster that could have 100 eyes, you know, in 500 BC. But now in 2018, a guy could sit in a room and have 100 eyes, just monitors.
Yes.
Drones and cameras all over the institution or campus or wherever we're being watched.
Yeah, that would be the more modern Argus.
Yeah, it would be, I guess.
I think the Defense Department named something after Argus at some point. They had to do with, watching.
Oh.
And then there's a newspaper in Rock Island, Illinois, that's called the Argus.
Huh.
It's spelled the right way and everything. It's like, now I know why this is called that. Yeah.
Always watch it. I might bleep out the Defense Department here just so they don't start watching us. I'm a little bit afraid.
It was in an article I read in the New Yorker one time. I have the clipping somewhere. I used to tell my students about it, and then it was too hard to explain what the stupid thing was being used for. So I gave up on it.
And I guess I keep coming back to this idea that monster stories maybe give us something to use in facing problems no matter what they are. So even surveillance state stuff, we already have the stories that tell us how to deal with that.
Yeah.
Because Hera was all in on that kind of thing. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking Greek monsters with me.
Well, thanks for having me. It was fun,